Today is Friday, May 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Coming up...
Well, the main speculation at the moment is on the future of the British Prime Minister, Theresa May.
That's reporter Henry Ridgewell in London. Also ahead, the Pentagon briefed the White House today about possibly sending thousands more U.S. troops to the Middle East. It's all on today's International Edition. Top Pentagon officials have given the president a wide range of options in response to rising tensions in the Middle East, including possibly sending thousands more U.S. troops to the Middle East. The top U.S. military officer, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, and Acting Secretary of Defense Pat Shanahan were among the briefers. The request for additional troops has come from U.S. Central Command, said another official who spoke to VOA on condition of anonymity because plans have not been formalized. For more on this developing story, my colleague Kim Lewis spoke with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, who is at the Pentagon.
One of the options would possibly be sending thousands more U.S. troops to the Middle East, but it's not clear whether that's something that the president is willing to consider. The request for additional troops has come from U.S. Central Command. That's what an official has just told me recently. But that's one of many potential ideas that could work to help put more pressure on Iran, officials say, in order to prevent them from lashing out and carrying out attacks on American forces.
So what are the expectations?
Well, we really don't know at this point. I will be trying to ask him a question in just a few minutes to see if he'll talk more on Iran, because for the most part, the Pentagon has been silent. And officials tell me that the Pentagon is trying to be silent because they don't want to get ahead of any decisions that the president makes. None of this is official. These are all options. This is a planning building. They plan for pretty much everything. And as you pointed out, it would be very different for the president to talk about reducing the number of U.S. troops in the region, particularly in Syria. He removed troops earlier and then all of a sudden wanting to add more.
Also, what has been any reaction from Iran on this?
Well, tensions between Tehran and Washington have been escalating since President Donald Trump announced his decision to try to cut Iran's exports to zero. The back and forth has been happening. As you've noticed, the United States has sent in a lot of military might already, an aircraft carrier strike group, another ship, Patriot missile battery. So a lot of things going on there. But we have seen the Iranian government condemn this and saying that the United States is escalating things. But the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps of Iran has said that, you know, if the United States does hit them, they will hit back. So it's very tense right now, and everybody is trying to urge the United States and Iran for calm and caution.
That was VOA's Carla Babb at the Pentagon. Tensions flared to another level between Washington and Beijing Thursday, and the two sides argued over a U.S. ban on China tech giant Huawei, fueling fear of a technology cold war. Reuters' Conway Gittins reports.
From Wall Street to the high seas to corporate offices around the world, nowhere seemed to be safe from escalating tensions between the world's two biggest economies. The U.S. and China squared off on many fronts Thursday, pressuring global markets as investors fear both sides are digging in for a long and costly trade war. The Dow down as many as 400 points. One major flashpoint, the Chinese tech company Huawei. Reuters trade correspondent David Lauder.
Rhetoric from both sides has been ratcheting up. You have statements coming out of Beijing that are rebutted by those from the United States. We saw that with Secretary Pompeo today. Secretary Pompeo basically said that the CEO of Huawei was essentially lying about Huawei's threat to U.S. national security.
Accused of having ties to the Chinese Communist Party, the U.S. blacklisted Huawei last week, forcing companies around the world to seek other suppliers. Fueling fear, Beijing and Washington are veering towards a technology cold war. Chinese officials aren't taking the escalation lying down, telling Washington to end, quote, wrong actions if it wants another round of trade talks to see the light of day. The Huawei ban isn't the only thing angering Beijing. Washington this week sent two Navy ships through the Taiwan Strait, considered a provocation in Beijing's eyes, since it sees the action as U.S. support for breakaway province. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Liu Kang.
The Taiwan question is the most sensitive to China-U.S. trade relations. We urge the U.S. to abide by the One China principle and the rules of three joint communiques between China and the United States, and to deal with the Taiwan relation questions carefully and appropriately to avoid negative effect on the China-U.S. relationship and the peace in the Taiwan Strait.
Diplomatic sources told Reuters, not only is it now unlikely President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping will have a trade deal to sign at next month's G20 gathering, the two may not even officially meet.
That's Reuters' Conway Gittins reporting. No group of Americans are being hit harder by the tariffs than American farmers. On Thursday, U.S. President Donald Trump rolled out billions of dollars in aid for farmers hurt by the trade dispute.
So today I'm announcing that I have directed Secretary Perdue to provide $16 billion in assistance to America's farmers and ranchers. It all comes from China. We'll be taking in, over a period of time, hundreds of billions of dollars in tariffs and charges to China. And our farmers will be greatly helped. We want to get them back to the point where they would have had if they had a good year. This support for farmers will be paid for by the billions of dollars our Treasury takes in. We'll be taking in, depending on what period of time we're talking, many billions of dollars, far more than the $16 billion that we're talking about. But the $16 billion in funds will help keep our cherished farms thriving and make clear that no country has veto on America's economic and national security.
U.S. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue said that the first of three payments is likely to be made in July or August, and suggested that the U.S. and China were unlikely to have settled their differences by then. Among the top stories in the world, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is accusing the United States of seeking to destroy a food aid program that the government says feeds some 6 million families. There was no immediate response from the State Department. A serial killer who terrorized Florida in 1984 was executed Thursday. His execution witnessed by a woman who survived one of the attacks and helped in his capture. The U.S. charges WikiLeaks founder with new criminal charges under the Espionage Act. An almost mile-wide asteroid is set to fly by Earth Saturday along with its tiny companion moon, though the space rock is designated a potentially hazardous asteroid, it is expected to fly by safely. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on voanews.com.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists from the University of Texas, Austin, and the University of Arizona in Tucson say they have found the remains of ancient ice sheets buried in layers 1.6 kilometers beneath the northern polar cap of Mars. Using data gathered by the shallow radar instrument on NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, the researchers found that each layer of polar ice was topped with a coating of windblown sand as the planet warmed. Writing in the journal Geophysical Research Letters, the scientists say the layers of ancient ice and sand, like layers on a cake, provides a record of the red planet's past climate. The growth and melting of the Martian polar ice cap is thought to reflect changes in the planet's orbit and tilt over the years. The scientists say that if the newly found ice were melted, it would cover Mars with water at least 1.5 meters deep. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
And this is VOA's International Edition. Early results from Thursday's ballot counting of India's massive general election indicate the ruling party of Prime Minister Narendra Modi is on its way to a decisive victory. My colleague Mario Ritter spoke to Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi about the results.
It's too soon to say, but basically what will be watched very keenly is how far he actually pushes ahead with much-needed economic reforms to push growth, to push investment, which appears to be flagging. India is the world's fastest-growing major economy, but economic growth has been slumping in recent months, and that is a cause of concern. However, some of these reforms are controversial, labor reforms, land reforms, and it'll take time for us to know whether Modi actually this time will be able to push ahead with these, considering that now, as you said, he has a much larger mandate.
With such a majority, will it make it easier to push the less popular reforms that may be needed to support growth and social change?
It should make it much easier because, along with his allies, he almost has a two-thirds majority in parliament. That's huge. He does not now have to rely so much on his allies or worry so much about the next election in the immediate few months or few years. It's going to be 5 years down the road. So hopefully Modi will now stick to his development agenda. Not easy in a vast country like this. It needs a lot of very, very controversial and very changes. But let's see how he fares.
What has Modi said about his critics who say he has increased social divisions in a country with many different constituencies, both religious and social?
I think that was one of the messages he was trying to give out when in one of his first tweets he spoke about building a strong and inclusive India, because he has received a lot of negative press in which he's been called a deeply divisive leader, as you said. He hasn't directly addressed this issue. It's a fact that the social divisions have deepened. It's a fact that there's been an increase in hate crimes against Muslims. A lot of these, of course, are not directly blamed on the BJP, but are blamed on fringe groups within the party. Now, the whole question will be whether these fringe Hindu groups get mainstreamed with the bigger mandate he has, or whether the bigger mandate allows him to clamp down on these fringe groups and lessen the social divisions. That is something that will have to be watched unfold in the months to come.
Now, if I could just go back to his speech just tonight, could you recap what you think are the most important points of that speech?
You know, it was a very divisive campaign. It was a very bitter campaign. He said, we will not go back on what was said during the campaign. We will look ahead. We will try to carry everyone with us. So obviously he's trying to put the bitterness behind and trying to carry the opposition with him, which is important despite the big mandate that he has, because the opposition can be very obstructionist in parliament. I think one of the other things, important things, was that he tried to communicate the message that India no longer votes on the basis of caste and community, which happened for many years. The new and aspirational India is increasingly looking for different things, is looking for development, is looking for a new message in the 21st century. That's one thing he repeatedly harped upon, that this is an India which we have to carry into the 21st century, and that is what the people want. That is what the mandate was for.
What is the early reaction from the opposition?
Well, I think the opposition was too stunned. They were absolutely decimated by the Modi onslaught, and no one was really expecting this. The worst result, of course, is for the main opposition, Congress Party, which was hoping to improve upon its earlier tally of 44 seats, but barely been able to get another 6 seats or so. This means there'll be a lot of questions about the future of the party, which dominated India for so many years. It has ruled India for most of the years since independence. Why it is getting sidelined? What are the reasons why it is not able to get its message across to voters? I mean, basically everyone is saying that the Congress Party will have to reinvent itself. In the early 1980s, the BJP held only 2 seats in parliament. I mean, and from there, it has built itself up to a party which is now holding more than 300 seats. On the other hand, the Congress used to hold a majority of the seats. Of course, it led a lot of coalition governments after 1984, but still it was always at the forefront of Indian politics. But this election has demonstrated that it is now sidelined, and it will have to come up with new strategies if it wants to reemerge at the center of Indian politics.
That's Anjana Pasricha reporting for VOA from New Delhi. Meanwhile, India's neighbor Pakistan fired a missile on Thursday. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with Michael Keelman, deputy director of the Asia program at the Wilson Center, who says the timing of the launch was not a coincidence.
Well, I think it was meant to coincide with the Indian election results. There was an expectation in Pakistan, as elsewhere, that Narendra Modi was going to be reelected. So I do not think it's a coincidence that this missile was tested at the very moment when Narendra Modi, a hardliner on Pakistan and the member of a political party that takes a hard line on Pakistan, was reelected. So I think in some ways this missile test was meant to be a strange form of congratulations to Modi. And really it was meant to project strength and resolve. And I think it was meant to suggest to India that, Pakistan is not going to be taken lightly, that it has the capacity to project military power and military strength, keeping in mind that it was not too long ago when India and Pakistan almost went to war. So the emotions are still raw over that crisis between India and Pakistan several months back.
But doesn't this make an already hard line, Narendra Modi, even harder with something like this?
I mean, to be honest, I don't think that he's going to pay all that much attention to this test. I mean, of course, he's basking in the glory of his election victory right now, and that's what he was doing when the test was done. You know, Pakistan has done these tests, has done a number of these tests in previous months and years. India has done the same. So I don't really think it's going to have much of an impact on Modi's thinking about Pakistan. I mean, if you look at the situation, when Modi first took office in 2014, when he was elected the first time, he actually extended an olive branch to Pakistan. He invited Nawaz Sharif, at the time the prime minister of Pakistan, to his inauguration. And it was some time after that when the relationship went downhill. But things are in a very different position now than they were back in 2014. Again, you know, you have the fact that only recently India and Pakistan almost went to war. So regardless of whether this missile test had taken place or not, Modi was going to take a hard line on Pakistan. His party has made it quite clear, and they made it quite clear on the campaign trail, that they're not in the mood to talk with Pakistan. They're not in the mood to launch a dialogue anytime soon. So that's quite clear. There's some pretty strong, emphatic thinking there on the part of Modi and his party. And so in that sense, this missile test was immaterial. It wasn't going to change the calculus.
Where do you put this dispute, and it's a long time running, as you mentioned, between India and Pakistan on the list of hotspots around the world?
I mean, I'd put it up at the top of the list. I mean, certainly, you know, these days we have to talk about North Korea, we have to talk about Iran, but I put India and Pakistan up at the top of the list just because, this is a case of two bitter rivals who both have nuclear weapons and have fought multiple wars against each other. That does not, there's no equivalent of that anywhere else in the world. And the fact that just a few months ago, India and Pakistan exchanged airstrikes, and they demonstrated that they're perfectly comfortable using force against each other, even under the nuclear umbrella. You know, for a long time, there had been a view that the fact that both countries had nuclear weapons would serve as a deterrent and make it unlikely that both countries would fight a hot war. And yet, you know, they both launched airstrikes on each other's soil a few months ago for the first time since 1971. So for all those reasons, I think we really need to be very concerned about the volatility of this relationship and the prospects for another war.
Michael Kugelman joined us via Skype. As always, thank you, Michael. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition. What looks like Prime Minister Theresa May's final days in office are turning into a drama without much precedence in modern British political history. With lawmakers in her ruling party in open revolt, ministers resigning, and more threatening to do so, joining a long list of dozens who've quit in the past 2 years, a teary-eyed May seemed determined Thursday to try to eke out some more time in Downing Street. Kim Lewis spoke with reporter Henry Ridgewell, who is covering the latest developments in London.
Well, the main speculation at the moment is on the future of the British Prime Minister, Theresa May. She faces another crunch point at the end of this week as members of her own Conservative Party decide whether she should continue as their leader. Of course, she has the ultimate decision on whether to quit or not. And there was an effort made by the party back in December by some MPs to get rid of her then, and that failed. And under normal party rules, the members of parliament would have to wait another year to make another challenge. But what they're trying to do now is change the rules so they can have another go at getting rid of her. That's an indication of the level of frustration in Theresa May's own Conservative Party that they want to get rid of her. They've given her an ultimatum. They say she could quit herself before the end of business tomorrow, that's Friday, but if she doesn't, they have laid votes on whether she should go or not. Currently, those votes are being held in a sealed envelope in one of the committees of the party, and if she doesn't quit, they're going to open that envelope at the end of tomorrow, which will give the backbench MP's verdict on whether Theresa May should continue or not. That's not the final say in the matter, because the rules would then have to be changed to allow them to get rid of Theresa May and launch a new leadership bid.
Is this unusual as Prime Minister for her not to want to resign and want to cling to power?
I think it's partly her nature as a politician, and it's partly the Brexit process itself that is seeing her stay on and cling to power despite the efforts to get rid of her. She's built a reputation as a very tenacious leader, someone who will try to see the job through despite the frustration with her leadership among large parts of the party. And she has become wedded to this idea of getting Brexit completed, of leaving the European Union, or at least getting the legislation to do so passed before she leaves office. But as we've seen over the past weeks and months, getting that legislation through Parliament has proved absolutely impossible. The withdrawal agreement that she signed with Europe, she's brought it to the House of Commons three times to be voted on by lawmakers. Three times they have resoundingly rejected it, twice with record defeats for the government in a major piece of legislation. And yet she's still trying again, and she's pledged to try a fourth time in early June to bring this withdrawal bill back to Parliament to be voted on by MPs. But all the indications are that there aren't more MPs coming on her side. In fact, quite the opposite. More and more MPs, even those who've been loyal in the past, now say they are going to vote against the agreement, that it's the wrong agreement entirely, that it's a hodgepodge of bad ideas that has tried to please everyone, but it's ended up pleasing no one. So it's very difficult to see how she carries on with her current strategy.
What are Brits saying about this?
It's a very divided British public now, and Brexit really has forged these divisions, which are going to be very difficult to get over. A significant proportion of the British public, I think, are sick and tired of Brexit and the debate and how it's paralysed British politics and British society. Just to give you an idea, there have barely been any votes in the Houses of Parliament in recent months just because everything is log-jammed with Brexit. So that's how some people feel. They just want to get it over and done with and move on to something else. Although the truth of it really is that the country is going to be debating and talking to Brussels about the future of the relationship with Europe for many years to come. And then there are many others who just want to leave with no deal at all. They say that's the best possible outcome. We just leave and then we're free to negotiate new trade deals with countries like the United States. And then there's a significant proportion as well who just want to reverse the whole thing, to revoke Brexit, to stay in the European Union. And what we're seeing is a hardening of each of these positions, more polarization on each side, and the middle ground really being hollowed out. And I think we'll see that in the results of the European parliamentary elections. That's happening today in Britain. People are out voting today to choose their next MEPs, a process that wasn't supposed to happen if we had have left the European Union by now. And I think we'll see very poor results for both the main Conservative and Labour parties, and a hardening and a polarization towards other parties from the further left or further right.
That was reporter Henry Ridgwell in London. For the very latest on this story, please visit us at voanews.com. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
Thank you for joining us today for VOA's International Edition. Environmental activists in Italy are increasingly concerned about the impact of plastic waste on marine life and the country's coastline. Their warnings are leading to measures to combat pollution on Italian beaches. Just this week, another whale washed up on a beach in Sicily with plastic waste in its stomach. Sabrina Castelfranco has more for VOA from Rome.
Italy's environment league, Legambiente, says that every year 8 million tons of waste suffocate beaches and seabeds. Its beach litter report issued this week revealed that its analysis of 93 beaches showed that more than 80% of the waste found was plastic. Once There Was the Sea is the latest initiative organized by Legambiente, which will involve thousands of volunteers in a mass cleanup next weekend on 250 beaches and coastal sites. Legambiente also urged the government this week to approve the Salvamare, Save Our Seas bill that will allow fishermen to bring to shore any plastic that accidentally ends up in their nets without having to pay for disposal costs. Greenpeace Italy sounded its alarm this week when another young sperm whale washed ashore on a Sicilian beach with plastic in its stomach. Giorgia Monti, campaign manager for Greenpeace, said five sperm whales beached in the last 5 months in Italy. She could not confirm whether plastic was the cause of the death of the latest whale found, but said it was very likely and it certainly could not be ignored as a possible factor. Monti added that the sea is sending us a cry of alarm, a desperate SOS. Later this month, Greenpeace is planning to launch a project to monitor plastic pollution levels at sea with a focus on the west coast of Italy. To stem the tide of plastic waste, initiatives have been launched across the country. Among new technology to combat pollution in many Italian ports, new sea bins are now active 24 hours and able to capture more than 1.5 kilograms of plastic a day. Simone Molteni, scientific director of LifeGate, explains how it works. He says it's a filter at water level that is able to clean up to 25,000 liters of seawater per hour, gathering microplastics and fibers. The mechanism is such that fish do not enter these sea bins that are placed in areas where the sea currents lead the waste. In 1 year, they have managed to collect 500,000 tons of plastic. While campaigners say much more needs to be done, some tourist resorts have banned use of non-recyclable plastic and have started to issue stiff fines to anyone found breaking the ban. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
And you've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com or download the VOA mobile app. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our broadcast team, Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Keith Holmes. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Have a great day.
This is VOA News.